thank you, Jerzy, and welcome here this afternoon. I was planning to project the text of my paper up there. The challenge is that I would have to keep scrolling through it. It's not regular PowerPoint because it's detailed stuff, but we don't have a long enough cable, so we'll have to rely on the handout to provide your basic structure, and then you'll have to listen closely. I'm going to have to move along relatively rapidly, and it's quite detailed material, but let's see how we do, okay? My title is The Unmanifestation of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, and that, of course, as you will recognize, includes a pun, because the name Epiphanes means manifest, God manifest. He didn't have a problem with lack of self-esteem. So, why is there a pun in my title? I guess you could ask, why am I Roy Gain? Anyway, let's go. Seventh-day Adventists derive our understanding of the pre-Advent judgment and its timing primarily from Daniel 7 to 9. However, we cannot afford to ignore Daniel 11, which largely parallels chapters 7 to 9 in historical scope. Because chapter 11 carries crucial implications for preterist versus historicist identifications of the little horn power in chapters 7 and 8. Preterists and historicists identify the little horn by reading Daniel from opposite directions. Bill Shea has pointed this out. Preterist critical scholars begin with Daniel 11, where they explain the despicable king of the north in verses 21 and following as the 2nd century BC Seleucid ruler Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He took this epithet, Epiphanes, which means God, and then Epiphanes means manifest. The Theos Epiphanes, the Theos is understood. He ruled from 175 to 164 BC. And the preterists take him to be the little horn. Since this king removes regular worship and sets up a desolating abomination, preterists then go back to chapter 7 and 8 and assume that Antiochus must be the little horn who commits those very crimes. So you see, they're reading chapter 11 in a certain way, and then they impose that as a template or framework on the earlier chapters. Historicists agree that the same ruler does these things in chapter 7, 8, and 11. That is, the little horn and the king of the north. But they read Daniel forward, so that the earlier chapters, chapters 2, 7 to 9, unfold a framework within which to interpret chapter 11. The result is that the little horn equals despicable king of the north is a Roman power, and the present paper critiques the preterist and historicist positions by examining Daniel 11. So we're going to the chapter that preterists use to see what support they have. Is there really Antiochus dominating this chapter? If so, he doesn't necessarily have to dominate the earlier chapters, but what is the role? Or is he here in a much lesser role? Bill Shea finds him very much whittled down to size just in verses 14b and 15 of chapter 11. And I'll tell you what my conclusion is. It's very much relevant to this. Okay, so this paper looks at this chapter, Daniel 11, to determine whether the person in verse 21 is Antiochus, as preterists say, or a Roman, which historicists say. I have no a priori objection to seeing Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes in Daniel 11. If he's there, it's okay. If the hat fits, wear it. I'll acknowledge it. That's all right. However, what I have found from exegesis of this chapter is a line of Seleucid monarchs up through Antiochus the Third the Great, the father of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, whereupon the prophecy skips over all the remaining Seleucid kings, including Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, and goes directly to Roman rulers. Therefore, the preterists are wrong in claiming that verses 21 and following, the entire rest of the chapter through verse 45, and futurists, of course, think that a lot of it deals with Antiochus, that they're wrong because I don't even see him in this chapter at all. I don't see anyone that he fits their description. Yes, analogies, similarities, yes, like Napoleon and Hitler were similar, both European conquerors, both conquered part of Russia temporarily, both driven out by the Russian winter, but Napoleon was not Hitler, and Hitler was not Napoleon. You see, they're analogies, but they're not just the same. My interpretation of Daniel 11, 1 to 22 presents two interlinked contributions. First, Whereas Seventh-day Adventist historicists have tended to avoid continuation of the Seleucid line up through Antiochus III, avoiding getting this close to Antiochus IV Epiphanes, you see why we'd want to bail out of the Seleucids earlier? Because we don't want to get too close, because if we get that close, then maybe someone will say, aha, why didn't you take the next step? Okay, so whereas Adventists have tended to bail out earlier, I agree with scholars, including a lot of mainstream scholars, who see striking historical correspondence with the text all the way up to the death of Antiochus III in verse 19. So Antiochus IV Epiphanes is already alive. And he's already grown up as a hostage in Rome. Okay, and that's important too. Second, I have discovered a crucial parallel between the transition from Medo-Persia to Greece or Macedonia and the transition from Greece, Macedonia, to Rome. When the transitions occur at the reigns of Persian Xerxes the Great and Greek Antiochus III the Great, who suffered catastrophic defeats with long-term consequences at the hands of Greece and Rome respectively, the prophecy skips the remaining rulers of the formerly prevailing dynasty, including Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and moves directly to the kings of the new prevailing power. Now you can see that on the handout. On the handout, look down there and you see at the end of the first couple of boxes at the top, you see a wavy line. See that very jiggly line? That represents a break. So you go down to Xerxes and then skip over all the remaining Persian kings. There were several of them, including some important ones, including Artaxerxes, under whose he was the one that gave the decree that Jerusalem should be restored. Okay? Now, then you have all of the Greeks and the Seleucids, but then look down on page 2 near the bottom. You see there's another wavy line just before that last couple of boxes. See that? And what I'm saying there is that the Seleucids go down to Antiochus III, who lost to Rome. Once he loses to Rome, Rome is the next prevailing power, and it skips to him because the Seleucids are not particularly relevant anymore. What is the dominant power? And that's my major point that I'll be presenting in this paper. Those two skips. With the first one is acknowledged by just about everybody. There's got to be a skip. You know, three Persian kings, the fourth richer than them all, goes against Greece. We know that he loses battles like Thermopylae, Marathon, and finally Salamis, the naval battle. Xerxes lost. Skips the remaining rulers. All I'm doing is to recognize the same thing, the same hermeneutical principle, when we get down to Antiochus III, that happens. But the rest of it is needed to justify the match between the text and the historical details to show that that actually happens. We can see already that that's a possibility, but I need to give you more support. So don't believe me yet, okay? I have two fears in teaching. The first is that people will not believe me. My second is the fear that they will, without checking it out. Be like the Bereans. Okay, now the next section is getting our bearings in Daniel 11. How do we navigate in this massive detail in Daniel 11? Since this chapter is complex, to say the least, we must get our bearings. At the outset, it helps to recognize that this chapter, like 9, 24 to 27, is strictly verbal communication with no symbolic vision. Since 9, 24 to 27 is an extension of the interpretation of the vision in chapter 8, it would make sense that chapter 11... I have to speak into this. For your sound, and this is only for the recording. Okay, thank you. I'm used to moving around. It would make sense that chapter 11 is also interpretive in nature. In other words, chapter 11 does not introduce any new kingdoms or powers. Rather, it further explains what has already been revealed. As in 9, 24 to 27, the non-symbolic nature of this chapter enables it to express more specific information. There are important differences, however, with the explanation in 9, 24 to 27. Whereas that passage in 9 focuses on the Jewish nation, chapter 11 has a focus that's much broader, and it parallels chapters 2, 7, and 8. Unlike earlier revelations in Daniel, chapter 11 presents a succession of anonymous kings within dynasties, rather than simply a succession of kingdoms or dynasties in which individual kings are only occasionally mentioned as distinct personalities. In terms of genre, this chapter is very similar to the Akkadian dynastic prophecy dated around 330 BC, in three respects, and these are important. Number one, there is a succession, not unbroken, as we've already seen, of anonymous kings in a concise, annalistic historical account. Secondly, the scheme of historical events associated with the kings is selective. So it just chooses a certain characteristics of those reigns. It's a lot like reading a horoscope. You notice that? I don't read horoscopes except when I come across them. I don't check my horoscope, you know, how's this day going to be, or my life. But when you look at a horoscope, it's sort of general, but it sort of refers to things as kind of a pattern or a profile overall. And that's why it's joint. Thirdly, the unnamed rulers arise within a named succession of world empires. It's easy to get lost in the massive details in chapter 11. However, we find a clear historical beginning point which everyone agrees on, and that's nice. Verse 2 explicitly commences with four Achaemenid kings of Persia, the fourth of whom must be Xerxes the First the Great, otherwise called Ahasuerus. He was the husband of Esther, who attacked Greece with a mighty invasion force, was driven back after the Greeks defeated him in the naval battle of Salamis. I have a footnote because there's another Jewish idea that it was really Artaxerxes instead of Xerxes, but I think I parried that enough, and I think it's enough people agree it's Xerxes. The mighty king in verse 3 must be Alexander the Great. Everyone agrees on that. I don't know of anyone who doesn't agree on that. Due to the fact that his kingdom is divided to the four winds of heaven, just as chapter 8, verses 21 to 22, describes division of the empire of the first king of Greece into four parts. And I hope you're following along on the handout. I'm just proceeding through that chronological flow. Without saying that our interpretation must follow a particular trajectory according to whether we have decided to be preterists or historicists, we can simply derive our starting hermeneutical framework from the biblical text itself in terms of what we've learned from the first few verses. Did I lose that? Oh, thank you. Okay, sorry about that. Without saying that our interpretation must follow a trajectory. Okay, we start with the biblical text. Number one, Daniel 11 refers to a succession of real historical rulers. That's a beginning hermeneutical point. That is Xerxes and Alexander. Without giving their names, but identifying them by brief references to salient features of their careers, especially events of military aggression. Two, there are gaps. We already mentioned that. The principle is this. It's only necessary to continue with one kingdom or line of kings until the new one of importance is introduced on the scene of action as dominant. Number three, in Daniel 11, there are clear links to preceding visions and interpretations, which help us to know where we are in the relative scheme of things. For example, verse 4 speaks of the Grecian Empire breaking toward the four winds of heaven, the same expression found in 8:8. In chapter 11, we don't have to explain this as division of the Hellenistic Empire. We already know that from chapter 8, which says explicitly in verse 21 that great horn belonged to Greece. There is no guesswork. That's part of the data. It's not part of the interpretation. That great king is Greece. And then the four divisions of that have to be divisions of the Greek Empire. The first two of these hermeneutical points result in two of the biggest problems we face. First, descriptions of royal activities are cryptic. In some cases, more than one ruler can be found from extra-biblical records to fit a given description. Second, it's not always immediately apparent where the gaps between the kings are located. Our greatest aid for dealing with these problems comes from the third hermeneutical point listed above, linkage with previous visions. William Shea points out crucial anchor points in Daniel 11, which can be established on the basis of comparison with the earlier prophecies in chapters 7, 8, and 9. 11:22, the Prince of the Covenant is broken, correlates with 9:25-27. And we can see from the whole exegesis of that, which we're not going to do here now, that has to be Christ. If you believe that Christ is the Messiah and he comes at just the right time, that's an anchor point, a chronological anchor point. That is Christ coming during the early part of the Roman Empire period in verse 22 of Daniel 11. 11:31, the so-called daily, which is better translated regular worship of God by his people, is removed by the little horn power. Then we find that parallels 8:11-13, abomination of desolation set up, uses some of the same language. It refers to the Tamid, The same word, which means regularity. So 11:31 parallels the little horn's work back in chapter 8, which we have identified the little horn with the later ecclesiastical phase of the Roman Empire, namely the Church of Rome phase. In 11:32-34 and 12:7, we find the persecution of the saints. And that parallels 7:25. So the persecution of God's people during the period of domination by the little horn, which we identify with the Church of Rome phase. Shea shows that the presentation in chapter 11 is in correct chronological order, reversing the chronologically reverse order of presentation in chapters 7 to 9 in terms of those three things: persecution of the saints, the removal of the regularity, and the Prince of the Covenant broken. Okay, so chapter 11 has the ordinary order. It's in harmony with the more literal genre of this passage, whereas the earlier chapters go in reverse, so they're chiastic. And a lot of times, as Shea has emphasized, the Hebrew thinking was to present the big overall picture, and then you fill in the details. So you go chronologically reverse from what the result is to the cause. Now, the next verses 5 to 13 of Daniel 11, everybody agrees, except for my colleague Jacques Ducan, that these verses 5 to 13, deal with the Ptolemaic and Seleucid dynasties. Okay, I will not have time, unless someone asks me a question, to deal with the theory of Jacques Ducan, which he's written in his Daniel, The Vision of the End and Secrets of Daniel. I have that as an appendix here, so I have examined that, and I have not adopted that approach. So I'm going to proceed with that, and I won't bring it up again unless somebody asks more about it. But I'm going to skip the next few pages here, down through verse 13, assuming that we get to already now the early part of the reign of Antiochus III. However, verses 14 to 19 become more problematic. Identification of historical events in verses 14 to 19 is more challenging. However, since verse 22 refers to the breaking of the Prince of the Covenant, which we can interpret as the death of Christ, 11:14 to 21 leads up to that event. So no later than verse 22, there must be a transition from the Hellenistic kingdoms to Rome. So the question is, where is that transition? So anywhere from verse 14 to verse 20 or 21, there needs to be a transition to Rome. Where does the transition to Rome come? Of course, the preterists don't have that transition to Rome at all. But they don't take verse 22 as the death of Christ. They take the Prince of the Covenant to be Onias, the high priest, which is unsustainable. Okay, I find that transition in verses 20 to 21, just before the Prince of the Covenant is broken, after considerable detail is given in verses 15 to 19 concerning the long and important reign of the Seleucid king, king of the north, Antiochus III the Great. This king is significant because he brought Rome into the picture by unsuccessfully attempting to invade Greece, just as Xerxes of Persia had earlier brought Greece into the picture by unsuccessfully attempting to invade that area. This correspondence carries a major implication, since at the beginning of the chapter, attention turns to Greece following Xerxes, so that subsequent Persian rulers are passed over. It appears that the attention of Daniel 11 will similarly turn to Rome, skipping later Seleucid kings following Antiochus III. But we have to test that idea. William Shea recognizes the parallel between Xerxes and Antiochus III, but he also sees a parallel transition during the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, whom the Romans forced to leave Egypt. The question is whether Daniel 11 describes the entire reign of Antiochus III, or only part of his reign, or also part of the reign of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, his son, with the Romans appearing in verse 14 or verse 16. I find that the textual allusions match the profile of Antiochus III to his death in verse 19, but do not match those of Antiochus IV at all. The allusions do not match the characteristics of his reign. Okay, verse 14. Many shall rise against the king of the south. And many scholars agree that some don't, but most agree. During the reign of the young Ptolemy V Epiphanes, 203 to 181, many Egyptians rebelled against their Greek overlords. And the Rosetta Stone discovered in 1799 by Napoleon's troops helps to illuminate that. It's about that. The remainder of the verse is problematic. My literal rendering is, "And the sons of violent or lawless ones of your people shall be lifted up in order to establish a vision, but they shall stumble." This may be talking about a short-lived attempt of a pro-Seleucid Jewish faction in Jerusalem to exploit the situation in Egypt in order to break out from under Ptolemaic rule of Palestine. Uriah Smith, however, followed by the SDA Bible Commentary and Maxwell, understood the Hebrew construct in the violent ones of your people as an objective genitive, the violent ones against your people, that signals the beginning of transition to the Romans, whose emergence as a superpower overlapped with the decline of the Hellenistic kingdoms. It was the Romans who fulfilled Daniel's prophecy by their violence against God's people, although Rome would eventually fall at the end of verse 14, as the end of verse 14 said it would. However, in the Hebrew text itself, there is no contextual or syntactic indication that the genitive should be taken as objective. So in violent or lawless ones of your people, of is most naturally understood in the sense of among Jews rather than against Jews, which would rule out the Romans here. So it would be Jewish lawless ones somehow trying to set up or establish a vision in some way. Shea takes, like your Smith and the others, takes the violent ones of your people as oppressors, but he identifies these as the Egyptians who were taken out of the way. Frank Hardy identifies the vision with the vision in chapter 8 and so on, but I do not accept those for the reasons that I've mentioned. There's not good enough evidence for it being objective, and also it would be strange in the case of Shea's idea of Egypt for the text to relate this event but not other more important events in this chapter as fulfillment of Daniel 8. And as far as the idea of Frank Hardy, who wrote his MA thesis on Daniel 11, it just doesn't fit in the right time frame. And furthermore, this verse seems to be speaking about antagonism against the king of the south, whereas Antiochus was a king of the north. So to say that this was against him doesn't really fit. Verse 15, "The king of the north shall come." Here's Antiochus preparing for another attack on Egypt. Of course, others who take the other track, there's been a parting of the ways, and they split off in other directions. But I'm going to skip over some of that. Verse 16, "But he who comes against him, he shall stand in the glorious land." This is interpreted by Smith, Maxwell, and others, Adventists, to refer to Pompey, 63 B.C., when the Romans took over Palestine. However, other scholars take it to be Antiochus III taking over Palestine. To me, that fits more naturally, and that works out much better. This does not fit Antiochus IV, certainly, because Judea was already part of his kingdom when he inherited it from his father. It much better fits Antiochus III. Verse 17, "He shall set his face. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom." And a number of Adventist commentators that I've mentioned say that this is the famous Cleopatra, you know, the Elizabeth Taylor Cleopatra, that one. And, however, I'm finding that in agreement with other scholars, it's an earlier Cleopatra. Her name was also, lots of Cleopatras and Antiochuses and Seleucuses and Ptolemies. This was an earlier one, and it doesn't fit the later Cleopatra who dallied around with Julius Caesar as his mistress, because she wasn't given. See, he shall give him the daughter of women. The Cleopatra of Julius Caesar was not given in marriage. It doesn't fit her. It fits in the earlier period. Verse 18, "He shall turn his face to the coastlands, the commander shall put an end to his insolence." This was Antiochus III defeated by the Roman commander Lucius Cornelius Scipio, and from this point on, the Romans had the upper hand. They forced the Seleucids to give up all their possessions. Finally, of course, right away, Antiochus IV was taken as a hostage to Rome, spent a number of years, 14 years, growing up as a hostage in Rome. That shows you how relatively weak the Seleucids were. "But he shall stumble and fall," in verse 19. I take that to be the assassination of Antiochus while he was attempting to sack the treasury of Baal, one of his own gods, in a temple in order to pay the tribute to the Romans. That's how down they were. Doesn't make sense to continue it with the Seleucids. Now, transition to Rome in 11:20-22. Scholars hold a variety of interpretations. I'm going to skip over the Preterist identification, which you are aware of. Smith and the SDA Bible Commentary have already introduced Rome. They continue this with the career of Julius Caesar, and then Augustus, the one who calls for taxes, tribute, in verse 20, and then the vile person they take to be Tiberius, who was not so light. Mervyn Maxwell parallels Smith in the Bible Commentary through verse 20, referring to Augustus. But in verse 21, Maxwell shoots over to the medieval papacy. These three interpretations have advantages and disadvantages. First of all, Hartman and Delella, preterists, continue with the natural flow of the Hebrew by seeing Antiochus III in up through verse 19. But the following verses, in verses 22 and following, go far beyond what Antiochus IV Epiphanes did. It doesn't fit their interpretation. Number two, Smith and so on see parallels between Daniel 11:20 and Luke 2 verse 1, where Augustus orders taxation, and that fits, that makes sense. However, some other aspects of the interpretation seem forced. For example, the idea of Cleopatra and so on. Maxwell has the same advantages and disadvantages as the Bible Commentary, plus some. The idea that the contemptible person is the papacy has the advantage that the rest of the chapter seems to deal with this power. But Maxwell does not adequately account for the parallel between the breaking of the Prince of the Covenant in verse 22 and in chapter 9, the death of Christ, which happens in papal, in pagan rather than papal Rome. And contradicting his own comments, his chart on page 295 places Daniel 11:22 under pagan or imperial Rome rather than papal Rome. So what's the solution? Consider the following exegetical factors. First of all, the expression, and we need to wind it up, okay? First of all, the expression, then there shall stand up in his place, occurs at the beginnings of these verses. Looks like it's putting someone else in a function. It doesn't have to be the next ruler in a dynasty, so you can have a gap. There can be functional equivalence in terms of who fulfills the place of the king of the north. Verse 20 says, and there shall stand up in his function one who makes an oppressor pass through. This doesn't have to be a tax collector. It can be an oppressor. This could be someone sending someone through like Ptolemy who would take over the people. It doesn't have to be someone like Augustus who sends out actual taxation. Okay, it has to be someone who lives a short time like Pompey did. Did I say Ptolemy? I meant Pompey. Pompey was going for the Romans, took over Palestine, died shortly thereafter. And he died because the Egyptian government, which was under the control of Rome, killed him because of the force of Julius Caesar. So he didn't, who was in a civil war with him. So he didn't die in anger or in battle. It was a calculated political move, not an assassination, not in battle. And this would fit Pompey pretty well, an oppressor who took over Palestine. It wouldn't fit Herod the Great, who reigned for quite a long time. The shortness of time in verse 20 is also problematic for the preterists, who identify this with Seleucus IV Philopater, the older brother of Antiochus Epiphanes, who actually reigned a dozen years. He reigned longer than Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So that really, that's the problem. You come down through the end of the reign of Antiochus III, and then it just doesn't match up. It says he shall die not in anger or in battle, after a few days. Both of those items do not fit the next ruler after Antiochus III Epiphanes, who was in between Antiochus III and Antiochus IV. It just doesn't fit. The text stops to fit at that point. And that's why I'm jumping to Rome, which fits. Verse 3, very briefly, my next point is the next ruler in verse 21 is despised or despicable. He's clearly a usurper. And this fits the ancient Near Eastern pattern of the usurper that shows up in the dynastic prophecy. Took advantages of times of political instability associated with violence and oppression. He wasn't given the honor of the kingdom. That doesn't fit Tiberius. Tiberius was given the honor of the kingdom. He was not a usurper. Neither was Antiochus really a usurper in that sense. He was in line to the throne. He was answering the problem of conspirators who murdered a predecessor. And then But it does fit Rome, if you look at it as the office of Roman emperors, starting with Julius Caesar, who usurped the power of the Roman Senate and came in this way, this subtle way and so on, very politically, took over, and then the Roman Emperor is continuing, and then that continuing down through the papacy. So I think, hopefully, I have demonstrated this idea that there is this break after Antiochus III, moving to Rome, and it stops fitting at the end of those, that is, after Antiochus III, the end of the Seleucid dynasty, does not any longer fit the Seleucids, but at that point it does start to fit Rome. You have gaps, and my bottom line is there is no Antiochus IV at all in Daniel 11. I think I've found that exegetically to my own satisfaction, and you can argue with me, but if that's the case, then it tremendously weakens the preterist case for Antiochus IV and the rest of Daniel. Okay, I'll rest my case.